Well, good morning, and thank you very much for coming to our session to hear about some things that are happening in the United Kingdom. Obviously, we come here to learn what's happening in the US, but also hope that we can in some way enliven the debate from across the pond, hear about the things that we're doing in Britain. So the outline of our session today is that we're going to talk a little bit about the campaign that we've been doing in the UK about the invisible calories on alcohol. It garnered some global attention in the media, which was very helpful because what happened is that people, you know, in the public domain, people began talking about it, which was a very useful thing for us. So Fiona, Sim and I will share the presentation, take you through, and Linda's going to provide the US perspective. And we hope at the end to have some questions or debate about your views on this subject. So first, a little bit of background. The Royal Society for Public Health, I think it always sounds very British, doesn't it? If it's got a royal in front of it. So that means it's old, and it is. So we are the longest established public health body. We've had loads of different names, but we're now the Royal Society for Public Health since 1876. We had lots of predecessor bodies. We have a multidisciplinary role, and I think that's quite important that the organization has been a multidisciplinary for a very long time. We're a membership organization and more, but we have over 6,000 members encompassing all sorts of different roles in protecting and improving public health. And we have a further 3,000 healthcare managers, because we have the Institute of Healthcare Managers too. So actually, as an organization, we cover the whole gamut from public health through health and social care. Across our members, we have directors of public health doctors, we have pest controllers, people who run water, people who run all kinds of food safety, hygiene, people involved in health improvement. So a really large body. And our vision is that everybody has that opportunity to optimize their health and well-being. So similar, obviously, to other public health organizations. But we're primarily an education organization, 70,000 qualifications every year, food safety, nutrition, hygiene, health improvement, understanding dementia, all kinds of different things. We've done water webinars for over 3,500 people in 68 countries, so we are also international. To give you a bit of a flavor of the kind of things we've been doing, we also accredit food safety training, and we accredit health hygiene and a hand washing campaign across Africa and Asia with Lifebuoy. So we're quite a varied organization. As many Royal Societies, we're also a dissemination arm for public health in general, and these are our academic journals, Public Health and Perspectives in Public Health. So we have Public Health has 350,000 downloads annually and around 900 submissions from 60 countries. So again, it's a very international group that we're talking to as an organization through both of our journals. But apart from that, we've been a big champion of what's known as the wider workforce. And the reason I mention this is that at the opening session yesterday, we heard a lot about tackling health inequality and the social determinants of health. And it's probably important to say that in the UK, we have been redefining who is involved in the public health workforce. And we've outlined 15 million people in employment in England who have the opportunity and ability to improve and protect the public's health. So we have gone some way to try and define and mobilize that group. But we think there are different ways to do it. And one of the ways to mobilise and get the information across is through our campaigning. Public health, as you know, is always in the news, and I was interested this morning to see that the USA is absolutely no different from England, and so this morning on CBS they had a nice piece about an outbreak of food poisoning at Chipotle. You must have seen that. And they also had something on alcohol, which is quite interesting, which says that actually alcohol doesn't destroy brain cells. So that made all the drinkers comfortable this morning, I think, on CBS. So that was all good. But so what are the public to believe? It's really difficult, isn't it? We're interested in having a dialogue with the public. We think it's important to find out what they think, because if we know what they think, that can affect policy making. And over the past 12 months, we've been doing a lot of work around talking to the public and experts and getting out policy papers so that we can move the debate along. We've had some notable successes. Our Stopping Smoking by Using Other Sources of Nicotine reached 350 million people because we made some recommendations about exclusion zones for smokers. So we've been making recommendations on all our policy papers around allergies, HPV, an awful lot of different subjects. And what we found is by polling the public and finding out what they think about things, using that in our campaigns, it's brought more press attention and therefore more public attention. So why did we do the campaign around alcohol and calorie labelling? Just to give you a bit of a perspective about what's happening in the UK. Almost 6 in 10 adults in the UK consumed alcohol in the past week. That was a very recent survey, so it's a very regular drinking habit in the UK. That we have over 9 million people drinking more than the recommended level. So this is not peculiar just to the UK, but we have some fairly specific problems. And as you all know, as public health people, it's the third biggest lifestyle risk factor for death and disease after smoking and obesity. And one of the things we wanted to do in our campaign was not talk single issue, but by talking about calorie labelling, bringing in the fact that the invisible calories in alcohol, there were two issues we were dealing with: adding to your weight and your alcohol intake. So what are the recommended safe levels? What does our government tell us? Well, they tell us, based on the evidence, that for men, 3 to 4 units a day, and women, 2 to 3 units a day. Now, a unit is 125 ml glass of wine. That's a very small glass of wine compared to the ones that are being poured right here in the hotel, and right here in various other hotels that I saw, which are more likely to be the 2.1 unit glass, which is the 175 mil, the average. And then in lots of our pubs across the UK, more common is the 250 mil, the great big glass of wine, which is in fact 3 units. You can imagine that most people don't really know what a unit is, and the fact that it's actually only a small glass. So, and for beer, depends on the strength of the beer, of course. And public perception? Well, they thought that alcohol only damages your health if you're regularly drunk or you're a binge drinker, because we have quite a lot of binge drinkers in the UK. So, again, concerns we have about awareness and people not really understanding what the safe limits. Again, the health risks, these are UK figures, but more likely to get mouth, neck and throat cancer. That's both women and men, though men have a slightly higher risk. For men, twice as likely to get liver cirrhosis if you're drinking steadily and you've got issues around blood pressure. Women are more likely to get breast cancer and blood pressure again. So we know the health risks, but it's worth stating them because people really don't know these risks. And the burden of alcohol-related illness. So The alcohol-related illness costs the NHS 3.5 billion a year. That's a lot to do with A&E departments and people arriving on a Friday and Saturday night, not being very well and having to have the stomach pumped or other such treatments, sort of regular in some places. And there were over a million alcohol-related hospital admissions, which I think is quite a lot, given that lots of that is preventable. And directly related deaths from alcohol, over 8,000. And if you think about as a contributing factor, so that's somebody that's at home and manages to fall over going up the stairs, then that's a contributing factor. They may break their leg, but actually they were a bit unsteady on their feet. So this is another factor that we're looking at in relation to alcohol. We looked then at how do we compare across the world. That's quite interesting. That you might not be able to see from where you're sitting, but the black is the heaviest drinkers, and you probably won't be surprised to see that that's Eastern Europe and Russia is the worst culprit in that sense. So if you look at the UK, tiny island, when you look at it like that, we compare with Canada and Australia, whereas then the US, you'd be pleased to notice, looking a little better on the consumption and how you consume the alcohol. So that's WHO figures, and I think quite instructive as to where the biggest drinkers are, if you like. The culture, though, different countries have different cultures. So while in the USA, from this you will see that on a per capita consumption, the UK and the United States are relatively similar, you'll see that we're at the top for heavy episodic drinking. So that's the binge drinking. So where we've got 33.4%, and if you look compared to Germany, for example, or Spain, or the Netherlands, we're looking at particularly bad across Europe. And it is about culture in the UK. Generational differences are very important. We have a culture where 16 to 24-year-olds don't drink all the time, but when they do drink, it's a really big problem. There's a lot of drunkenness, a lot of binging. At the opposite end of the spectrum, it's really the over 45-year-olds who are steady drinkers. So they're not getting drunk, they're not falling over, they're not standing in the streets without a coat on the snowy night. But they're actually drinking steadily and quite a lot. And that's an increasing problem in the UK, is the over 45s, and particularly, so we're told by our chief medical officer, the over 65, so a concern about that. We looked at binge drinking. We said, is this a new phenomena in England? And actually, it isn't really, though these are some of the lovely tabloid headlines that you, you're lucky that you don't have as many tabloids as I think we do in the UK. And you'll see some of our lovely binge Britain here, and you'll see some of the high streets on a Friday and Saturday night. We have a very, very bad reputation across Europe, in particularly in the summer, when piles of young people go to Spain, Greece, and other cities in hot countries and cause chaos. So boozy Britons drink the most alcohol in Europe, and binge Britain's night of shame, so half-clad people around some cold high street somewhere in England, no doubt. So this is a very common sight, and it's something that we see a lot of. And what's the definition of a binger? So we have a definition. It's 8 units in 24 hours for men and 6 units in 24 hours for women. But many of the people will go way across that. Is this a new phenomena? Well, we know from the literature that heavy drinking has been part of British social life for a long time. And we have kept changing our minds about it as the centuries have rolled on. and it has been seen as an integral part of the social fabric. So all of our public events, private occasions, it's very much again part of the culture. In fact, on at George III's coronation, they had a wine fountain in the middle of Newcastle that everybody could come and celebrate by getting wildly drunk at the fountain. But in 1751, we changed that. There were lots of reasons for that, but part of the beer culture was that the water was so very bad that people were getting very ill from waterborne disease. So drinking beer really helped keep people a bit healthier, actually falling for disease. But by 1750, this is a William Hogarth painting. It's a very famous painting. But what he's done here is, it's almost like you'd find in our newspapers today, he's showing you the increasing concern about gin. And you can see that this is the equivalent of our binge drinking that I've just shown you on newspapers now. You've got the falling over drunk asleep. You've got the antisocial behavior here with all the fighting and the violence. And then you've got a really bad mother because the baby's about to fall on the ground and hit its head. So this is irresponsible mothers were part of that. And this led to the Gin Act of 1751 and a big clampdown. So Britain has gone in all these phases. This is 1929, and this was one of our, I put this in because this is one of our organization's predecessor bodies, the Institute of Hygiene. And the Institute of Hygiene said, our certificate, so accrediting this bottle of booze dry gin, it's your guarantee of absolute purity. So in 1929, a public health organization was actually saying, go out and get booze gin because it's better than the other type. So again, I think just to give you a bit of background on where we've come from, this is the UK background. So I'm now going to hand over to Fiona, who's going to give you the details of our campaign.
Hi, I'm just going to carry on. I'm Fiona Sim, Chair of RSPH, and hopefully this will flow seamlessly. We just thought it would be nice to have more than one voice and have three of us speaking this morning. So, there we go. More recently, this is. Britain is known as a nation of warm beer drinkers. But actually, in the last few decades, we've taken up spirits and wine and followed our European brethren much more than had done in previous times. So since the 1960s, we've moved into stronger alcohol, and the beer's got stronger as well, and the lager. But overall, in the last few years, total consumption seems to be coming down a little bit, which may or may not be a trend that's going to continue, but worth just noting. So moving on to obesity, because that's what this is really all about, was trying to understand what the links might be between people drinking alcohol socially and the rising prevalence of obesity in our adult population. So from 1993 to 2012, you can see that the proportion of people with a normal body mass index, BMI, has come down quite substantially. And the proportion of people who are obese has risen by 10%. And that's not getting any better. So, putting it into a worldwide perspective, again, this is for women, so adult females. You can see the darkest areas are the areas with the highest proportion of people with high BMI. As you know, you do rather badly here in the US. We don't do very well, and we're getting worse. And similarly for men, we're getting worse, and the whole of North America is doing badly, as is Australia and a large chunk of South America. So we're facing effectively a pandemic of obesity. We all know that. which is why we were interested to know more about this possible link and address it. So where's the evidence? So far, the evidence is relatively slim, and certainly we don't want to suggest that there's a causal link. There may well be, but it's not yet proven. So of those people who drink, we know in the UK that alcohol is providing about 10% of their daily intake of calories. Most people wouldn't have a clue that that was the case. People who are social drinkers, having a few glasses of beer a week or a couple of bottles of wine during the week, wouldn't know that 10% of their calorie intake comes from alcohol. We don't know about whether there is yet a causal relationship, but we do know that binge drinkers are more likely to be overweight or obese. So what did we do? We did a few little pieces of market research and experimenting. This is not full-blown academic research. I'm quite clear that it isn't, but it was a very interesting project to work on. So we commissioned some market research, a random online poll of just over 2,000 adults in Britain. And over 80% really didn't have any idea about the number of calories that might be in the glass of wine that they were asked to estimate. And even more didn't have any idea at all about the calories in a pint of beer or lager. So that didn't really surprise us, but it was useful to know, to have that guess that people didn't know endorsed by a market research piece of opinion polling. So we thought we might ask you if you know, given that there's no time like the present to do a little bit more market research. So is there anybody here that is happy to say that they're teetotal, because then you're allowed to be exempt from needing to know? Okay, right. Okay, I think these are going to come up one at a time if I'm lucky. So would anybody like to tell us how many calories there are in a 250ml glass of wine? Now 250 was the big glass, the sort of glasses that we get in pubs or bars in the UK. 150. 300. 250. 180 calories. So it's less than you might have thought. But it is equivalent of having to walk for 2 miles to work off those calories. So those of you who are carrying your pedometers, you'll know. Or an average slice of pizza. I have a sneaky feeling that a British slice of pizza might be slightly smaller than a US slice of pizza. but we'll go with this. So think British when you're thinking of these comparisons. But the calories are the same. We share our at least calories are one thing that we do have in common. When we were putting this presentation together, we had to try to keep comparing correctly, which is why we were talking about 560ml of beer, because that's an English pint is nothing like your little pints. But we had to be clear about that. Okay, a pina colada. A lot more, you think? A lot more seems right. Okay, 450. Yep, well done. So you can have a whole cheeseburger for that, or you've got to get out on your bike for an hour and a half. Okay, lastly, the pint of lager. 220. So you're converting to a beer.
Everybody's drinking beer.
So you're going to be changing to lager. This is a fairly light lager, okay, not a strong lager that my patients with alcohol problems drink strong lager. They're very proud to tell me this is ordinary lager. There is a little bit, but not very much. So where are we in the UK as far as labelling is concerned? And Linda's going to give us the US story shortly. But our labelling requirements in the UK are dominated by the European Union legislation. So we have to have units labelled on packaged alcohol drinks. This is not what you get when you go into a bar or a pub, where there is no requirement, as far as I know. The strength, so you get 4% by volume or 11% by volume and so on, the strength of the drink. More recently, allergens, which I believe is still optional on alcoholic drinks, we'll come on to that in a minute, and the use-by date, which is interesting. Okay. All right. Health warnings are voluntary. And for the last few years, we've had something called the responsibility deal, led by government working with the industry, both the food and alcohol industries, to look at key messages on food labels. And all of that is about agreeing voluntary labelling. The target was that there would be 80% of health message labelling by 2013. Now that's been achieved, but in a very modest way. So depending on who you speak to, most of us in public health find that the responsibility deal has been very disappointing in terms of what it's delivered. The government, however, will say, well, it's delivered on its key objective of delivering health message labelling. But whereas you might get on a bottle of wine, pregnant women are advised not to drink very much, you won't get most of the other health information that perhaps as a public health community we might want to see. There's quite a lot of contention around the real effectiveness of a voluntary agreement, which is what we've got so far. And obviously it depends on which side of the argument you are. The libertarians would say, why regulate any of this? It should be left to individual choice. The public health community generally thinks quite differently, but we can return to this discussion. But certainly one of the things that's very rarely on labels at the moment is the calorie content of drinks. Okay. So where are we at the moment? 6% of beer had calorie information, 3% of spirits, 1% of wine in a recent European survey. So minimal uptake of that particular voluntary option. Some of the spirit manufacturers are saying that they're very keen to add calorie labelling, which I think we should encourage and support. When you look at the detail of that, one of the manufacturers that's been particularly vocal about saying they're enthusiastic is keeping very, very small the size of the font that tells you how large the glass is that they're talking about number of calories of, and it's the smallest of the glasses that Shirley showed you on the earlier slide, 125. So our little poll of just over 2,000 people, market research, showed that more than two out of three people thought that labelling with calories would be a helpful thing to do. This is just a mock-up of what that might look like. Personally, I'm not sure that telling people what's in a 125ml glass is necessarily the answer, because most people wouldn't know that they're usually getting a third more or twice as much more in a typical glass when they order it in a restaurant or in a bar or a pub. So I think we need to think more carefully about the nuance of the labelling and how impactful it actually is going to be, rather than just going with the label because it seems a good idea to have a label. So actually what's in the label is going to be really critical. It's going to be useful for people to make choices. And this is not moving. I don't know why. I'm not sure why I'm stuck here. Okay. Maybe this. All right. So, Okay.
Yeah.
This might work. This is a video. So what we did after our market research, we decided to do a little experiment in a pub. Has anybody here not been to a public house, a pub in the UK? All right. For those of you who have never been in a pub in the UK, they're, by and large, these days, they're smokeless. Very pleasant places for anybody, adult, to go and have a drink. And a lot of people will go there after work, typically, on a weekday, to have a drink. They very often serve minimal food, like a bag of chips, or something called pork scratchings. And if you don't know what that is, come and ask us afterwards, because it's absolutely dire. So they're not known for food, by and large. I mean, increasingly, pubs are serving food, and they've become gastropubs. But by and large, people will go for a drink after work. They'll sit in a fairly pleasant, convivial environment. There might be some music, there might not be. Anyway, so we went into the pub just around the corner from our offices and mustered up a few people and asked them to play a game with us, which they kindly did. Please note, I'll stress again, this was a little experiment in a pub. It's not pretending to be scientific research, but I think you'll like it. Oh, now I'm lost again. I really hope this works. Here we go.
Okay.
Thank you. Congratulations. It was a very cold day, I should say, and I was outdoors.
Okay, what we've done is invited people to take part with us in an experiment about how it is to drink alcohol and whether the alcohol that they drink might affect the way that they play their games and how well they do.
From what I've heard, it's we've taken alcohol and we're going to see our reaction time versus we get into the plane.
What we've actually done in addition is given the menus from which they can choose the drinks.
We're dividing the groups into two. First group, we're giving them a menu with calorie labels on, and the other group, we're giving them a menu without calorie labels on. What we're trying to do is find out whether or not calorie labeling has an effect on whether or not people drink more or less, or change what they hold up.
A little small scale experiment to see whether having the calorie values on the drink menu might make a difference to their choices.
To be asked whether they thought calories had made a difference to their choices in terms of drinks. It was completely unexpected.
Looking at the menu of the drinks, the fact that the calorie content was listed was unusual, and so it was commented on at the time. Definitely noticed the calorie marking on the menu, because we had a little discussion about, oh, this is our show, and we see this on a beer menu. And one of the team members, she picked the beer with the lowest calories in the end.
We know that alcoholic drinks can, by and large, contain quite a lot of calories, but a lot of people don't think about that at all when they're either buying alcohol to drink at home or drinking in pubs and restaurants.
I mean, I'm quite used to looking at calorie content and things, so actually it did affect my choice of drink.
Well, we know that we've already got a lot of interest in food labelling. What we haven't got is calorie labelling of alcoholic drinks. Now, our theory is, why not try it, please, to see if you're able to make choices.
For people like myself who kind of, it can't be a good thing, I will do a good thing if I know, that would make a difference to someone like myself.
I think it's more likely to have an effect than alcohol. I think people probably think more about calorie control than they do about alcohol control. It's probably a sad thing.
If I see that I can do something a little bit better, then I will. And so that's useful for me making an important decision.
In the same way that people think about calories in terms of food, people will be interested in terms of alcohol. What was surprising about this evening was you never see it in respect to alcohol. you only see it with respect to food and not even animals.
I hope you found that interesting. I should say everybody in the film consented to be shown. They were delighted to be participants. They did drink less. I'd have to go back to the raw data to answer that, to be honest. I don't have the figure, but by the looks of it, probably about half. But significantly less, certainly, yeah. But they were influenced by the calories, as they were saying. And we found it really fascinating. So what we're looking to... Hopefully, somebody will take this up and do some academically-based research to demonstrate this. But we think it's interesting stuff so far. So where are we with alcohol calorie labelling? So in Europe, as I said before, food labelling is an EU competency. That means we bow in the UK to the decisions made by the European Parliament around the labelling of foods. And at the moment, the legislation excludes, for food labelling, excludes alcoholic drinks with an alcohol content of more than 1.2% by volume, which is most drinks, as you'd appreciate. The European Commission debated this and looked at this last year and committed to producing a policy document by December 2014. That document is awaited and has still not appeared. Do you want to interrupt? Yeah, go for it. The history?
Right, why is that
Yeah, there are hardly any alcoholic drinks with alcohol limit that small. What it allows to include are things like Christmas puddings and tiramisu desserts and other things that have got a very low alcohol content, but very few alcoholic drinks would come anywhere near that low level. How they actually reach 1.2%, I'm sorry, I don't know. There may be somebody else in the room that knows the detail of how the European Parliament reached that decision. I'm sorry, I don't know. But I think it was really to include foods containing alcohol, but to exclude drinks.
Right. So, is it always included alcohol
drinks? It has, yes, previously, yes. Yeah. It's always excluded. The first time legislation was brought in, alcoholic drinks were excluded. Before that, there was no legislation, no regulation at all for labelling. When labelling was brought in, it effectively excludes alcoholic drinks. So the European Commission was supposed to produce a policy document December last year, hasn't done so to date. The members of the European Parliament were asked to vote on the subject in the absence of the policy document, and helpfully decided to take that vote and voted in favour of calorie labelling in April of this year, which effectively puts pressure on the European Commission to come up with a policy document. Nevertheless, we're still awaiting it. Okay. So, yes, sorry. There is a growing lobby in favour of alcohol labelling. Yeah, it's a good strong lobby. Well, I say good, sorry, it's a judgment on my part. It's a strong lobby in favour of alcohol unit labelling. Is a very strong lobby. Calorie labelling, in effect, we're riding on the back of the unit lobbying, which has been there for several years. We're saying calorie labelling ought to be taken at the same ought to be included at the same time as unit labelling, because it just makes sense to do both at the same time rather than piecemeal. So we're continuing to lobby, as are many other public health organisations in the UK. I talked about this in Europe last week at the European Public Health Association meeting, and it was news to people there that I spoke with. So I was hoping that some of the European Public Health organisations will also get more interested in this aspect of food labelling. So you can watch this space and be interested to know how much interest there is here as well. So we think we need more research about what kind of labelling would be effective. I think there's more to it than just putting a glass and a number of calories on it. You saw from that little experiment that actually having something written on there, on the menu in a pub or in a cafe or a restaurant seems to be something that people would engage with. It would be really helpful to have more research to find out more. We think the industry should engage with all of this. As I said, they're inclined to do so, but we don't know if they're inclined to do so in a way which will be helpful. The industry, we feel, is not that likely to be enthusiastic about something that might make people inclined to drink less, so there's quite a lot of work to be done there. I'm just stating the obvious. And carrying on lobbying is important. So thank you very much for listening. And I'm going to hand over to you.